Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of June 2023. Welcome to episode 97 of this podcast series, making this also the anti-penultimate episode of this podcast series. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I read since the last time I did one of these episodes, which should make this pretty much the books I read during June. These comics are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost them on my Facebook and Twitter so you can find those. But those posts aren't really spoilers for the podcast, since those are just lists. And here, there's a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. Podcasting's Michael Bailey responded to the Bailey signal I sent up when I uttered the word mullet in the April episode. Consider your attempt to get my attention successful. Then he added a keeping my eyes on you gif before relating an experience that he had had on a recent vacation. I saw pictures of this dramatic and momentous event. I ran into your boss, Professor, while I was on vacation last month. Nice guy. He was hanging out with Norman Osborn, so that wasn't the best background for a photo, but it was nice to get my picture taken with Dr. Doom. I checked in on this, Mike, and Doom said it was nice to get a picture taken with you as well. A lot of people don't know this, but Doom is a big fan of podcasts. They are playing pretty much 24/7 Inside the Mask. Pro tip, Doom listens at 1.75 speed, just saying. James Williams, a.k.a. James from Karen, wrote in with comments about the future of the network, including the future of this very show, which I discussed on a recent quarter bin, actually. It was there that I said that episode 99 would be the final episode of the Reading Journal. And James said, I'm going to miss the Comics Reading Journal. It's become my favorite of your podcasts. It is unique. I haven't heard anyone else doing anything remotely similar. I was a massive fan of Disney comics. So I love that you talk about Disney, Archie, Dell, Gold Key, and Harvey Comics almost every month. Nobody else mentions Archie, Super Goof, Yogi Bear, or Daffy Duck as regularly as you do. I was also a big fan of creator-owned comics in the 80s, so I like the variety of comics you cover every month. More importantly, I will miss the end of your specials. I love you adding people to the roundtable and naming a listener of the year. Part of what makes you a wonderful podcaster is how much fun you have with your listeners. I was an IT database guy, so I love your end-of-year reading stats and when you name your favorite issues of the year. I heard a podcaster recently describe podcasts as a waterfall. A new episode starts at the top of the feed and is quickly lost among all the other old episodes. I've listened to a lot of episodes on the Relatively Geeky Network, Dorkness Delight, and the Quarterbin Classics feed. I will add, James, the much-overlooked Quarterbin Classics feed. But I think I've fallen way short of listening to all 400-plus episodes that you've released. Have you ever thought about recording quick new intros to favorite old episodes and re-releasing them? I know Karen is doing something similar over on her Between the Pages blog with the Spider-Verse and Flash movies that are coming out soon. It would give you a chance to repurpose old content and take a break. All my best, James from Karen. Thank you, James. I love that both of you appreciate the James from Karen joke. Knowing that warms my heart. Some points on items that you raised. First, to celebrate the upcoming 10th anniversary of the network. Here in July 2023, Em and I are planning to re-release the first Short Box Showcase episode, and then a few days later, release an anniversary special that will include some reflections on re-listening to that episode, as well as talking about the 10 years that have followed. That's not exactly what you were saying, but it's, I think, in that same neighborhood. And over the last 10 years, I've repurposed content a handful of times, probably fewer than 10. But I do agree that it's definitely something that could happen again. I like Karen's idea of reusing old content when it ties in to the calendar in terms of something being released or a theme or a topic that's in the news. That I like conceptually. Now, as Em and I will discuss in that episode, so this is spoilers, I guess, there will be some kind of replacement show for the reading journal, something that won't talk about every comic that I read, but certainly about some of them, probably most of them. But it'll also be a show that gives me an opportunity to talk about books, sci-fi magazines, TVs, movies, all of that. And yes, I will definitely keep the end-of-year analysis. You are not the only person who has pointed out how much they enjoy that. Sir Martin of Grey also expressed his displeasure of the looming end of the show, mostly about ending at episode 99 instead of the big round number of 100. Here's the thing, Mark. Every podcaster knows this. Once you break into triple digits, once you get to 100, you're kind of committing to go to 999. It's kind of like a Y2K thing, you know, the number of digits and all that. And frankly, I don't think I can promise another 70 years of episodes. So I think 99 is a reasonable place to end. But like I said, a similar show will take its place. Maybe not monthly, maybe more often, maybe less often. All of that is up in the air. And yes, it will certainly be a pale imitation, I'm sure. But think of it this way. Lots of people really liked Coy and Vance. And social media support for last episode came from The Batpod, Between the Pages, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, Evan Bevins 51, The Notorious, JJG from comics.blog, Chris Lydon 7, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, D.S. Putnam, Chris from Professor Frenzy, Paul DeBetta, Doc Freak, the kind and lovely Sutherlands, Pat from the Long Box Crusade, Gene Hendricks and Sir Luke, both from Two True Freaks, The Telltale Mind, and the aforementioned Sir Martin of Grey from the excellent blog Too Dangerous for a Girl. And now on to books that I read last month. As I do on this show, I'm categorizing the books that I read. And first are the issues that I read specifically for podcast appearances. These are the homework books. And for the next episode of the Quarterbin Podcast, I read The New Adventures of Superboy, 35. And for an upcoming pair of episodes with Billy Dee in The Brave and the Bob, I read a pair of Cave Carson issues, The Brave and the Bold, 40 and 41. And comics I read for listening to podcasts, and they're getting to be a good number of these, because of the DC Infinite app and DC Comics-themed podcasters, who I thank for their content. Mention Billy Dee in The Brave and the Bob. And to follow along with episodes 24 and 25, I read Brave and the Bold 63 and 106. 63 features the Super Chicks, a.k.a. Wonder Woman and Supergirl, in a truly bizarre story. And for his Magazines and Monsters show, episode 67, I read Superman's Girlfriend, Lois Lane, number 15. And for listening along with Laurel, a.k.a. Mountain Flower and her crew, on episode 205 of Feathers and Foes, I read Birds of Prey 7 from the New 52 era. And moving on to new comics that were read right off the shelves, and we actually do have a few this month of the digital variety, thanks to the Hoopla app. House of Slaughter 11 through 14. And the reason I ended up reading four in a row of these is because issue 11 had not yet showed up on the app, even after 12, and then 13 and eventually 14 appeared. So when 11 finally did show up, I read all four to get caught up. This is the new storyline, The Butcher's Return, which moves us away from the titular House of Slaughter, introducing us to another family, the Butcher Shop. We meet their head recruiter, I guess, and follow her as she brings a talented youngster into the fold. It's a horror title, and this storyline is not the bloodiest thing we've seen yet, but it might be the darkest. It might be the most horrific. And to the general comic reading that I did, from Sir Iowa's Joe, Eternal Warrior, number 6. This is from the original run of 1993. The time is Mardi Gras. The place is Nolens. Although we spend some time in hell, that's what happens when you battle a bad guy named Master Dark, D-A-R-Q-U-E, because comics. Joe also sent an issue where I can see what they're doing. Like I see all the elements, and I see that they aren't bad. But as a whole, Errand Boys number 1 from Image just didn't do much for me. It just seems like every element in the storytelling was turned up to 11, and I'm including the lettering here. So let's just go with not really for me. Joe also sent in from Mark Miller, Chrononauts, Future Shock 2 through 4 of 4. Unfortunately, Joe did not send in Chrononauts, but that's another story. This is an interesting time travel tale where the inventor of time travel has used time travel to improve the world into a paradise that Gene Roddenberry would envy, while also using time travel to erase all knowledge of time travel, which is a pretty great setup. But of course, things go wrong in the past, and the Chrononauts are sent to fix it, and shenanigans ensue. You think I'd be used to this next thing I'm going to mention, but it did bum me out that the terrible things in the past, what it was that led to the apocalyptic wasteland, was, of course, my worldview and beliefs. That's right, turns out the bad guy was me. And from Clinton, from Coffee and Comics, X-Men Clandestine number 2 from 1996. The cover promises 48 fun-filled pages, and I must say that there were definitely 48 pages here. And they were definitely filled. I mean, they were filled with dozens of characters, filled with word balloons, filled with Alan Davis art, so that certainly helps. But I did not find any of the promised fun in the 48 pages. And from the cheap bins at Half Price Books, from Robert Kirkman at Image, Super Dinosaur 2 through 6, a pretty fun all-ages style book. You have a family with a giant pet dinosaur, a flying, talking super dinosaur, as a matter of fact. The family is a super science family, and they've developed mech suits for their son Derek, and even one for SD, that's Super Dinosaur. And of course, in the spirit of comic books, the villains they battle are also dinosaur-themed. So if bad guys like Triceratops, or the Terror Dactyl, or even Squidious appeal to you. Along with some tween-appropriate drama and action, this might not be a bad choice. And from Hoopla, wrapping up Christopher Cantwell's run, Iron Man 20 through 25 from the last year or two, I was bummed about how quickly the relationship with Hellcat is dispatched, but coming to the end of his run, I suppose Cantwell needed to put some of the toys back in the box the way he found them, but still, that seemed awfully quick. A lot of action in these last handful of stories, including Tony battling a super smart ape, which really makes me think that Cantwell maybe is auditioning to work at DC. The main story arc has Tony regretting his weapons-making past and doing what he can to make up for that. It culminates with a bit of a showdown with Riri Williams about the best way to dispose of the Mandarin's 10 rings. I really enjoyed how Cantwell treated my favorite character in his Doctor Doom work, and so I wanted to hear from one of the biggest Iron Man fans that I know, so I solicited some pre-feedback on this Cantwell run from Sir Luke Giaconetti. And the good sir did not disappoint. As an Iron Man reader since the mid-90s, I am personally tired of new writers feeling the need to tell a story about how Tony's not really a great hero, again, needs his friends and allies to get anything done, again, fails any time he's given any measure of power, again, and needs to be redeemed, again. That said, if you are going to do that, Cantwell's approach of tearing Tony down and forcing him to build himself back up several times is a much better take than others, which seem primarily interested in axe grinding. After the big, bombastic storytelling of Dan Slott's, Cantwell's run was first pitched as a back-to-the-basics take for both the title as well as for Tony himself in the story. It does seem like this was an intentional misdirect by either Cantwell, Marvel, or both when the title transitions to sprawling space opera. That turn legitimately surprised me, and I must give credit to Cantwell for swerving me in such a good way. The use of Korvac as the big bad of the first major arc is a choice I could not have predicted, and he ended up telling a memorable Iron Man epic. Definitely have to give the creative team credit for ambition. You know, Luke, I was thinking about this and about the constant need to drag Tony and then possibly often redeem him. You know, back in the early days, the way Stan told the story, and let me stop here and say that Stan reminds me a lot of my late mother. She loved telling stories, and every time she told the same story, it got better and better. It got funnier and funnier. And when Stan told stories, he had that same impetus, I think, which was to entertain the people hearing the story and not, you know, prioritize the telling of historic versions of what, you know, actually factually happened. That all said, as a caveat, Stan claimed that he wanted to make a hero out of someone who was generally not heroic, a concept which included his career as a weapons manufacturer. So to some extent, not to defend every writer who has dragged Tony through the dirt, that sort of is kind of one of the points of the character. I know that's a bummer as a fan, but I say that for better or worse. Now, Luke adds that he was disappointed that Cantwell clearly did not like the existing Tony-Janet Van Dyne romance when he took over the title. That was one of my favorite elements of the previous series. The breakup scene, where Janet does not even change from wasp size, seems to demonstrate how little Cantwell thought of that relationship. Coupled with the series essentially serving as a backdoor pilot for Hellcat, which Cantwell ended up writing, it seems like he did not want his leading lady to be overshadowed. I like Hellcat, and Patsy was a surprisingly good sounding board slash foil for Tony, but losing Wasp was an overall negative for me. I liked Cantwell's use of odd or obscure characters, including Misty Knight, Scarlet Spider, Frogman, oh yes, Frogman, the bevy of old-school shellhead villains, the incredibly obscure Avro X, and of course, Stiltman. Plus, seeing Dr. Doom pop up is naturally always a treat. Preach it, Luke. Preach it. Similarly, the Source Control storyline was a change of pace from the sci-fi space opera and back to a more traditional modern Iron Man story. Buying his way out of a problem is a classic Tony Stark idea, and the fact that it goes about as well as one would expect is spot on. I enjoyed the story's progression and how Cantwell brought in characters such as Riri Williams and Force. I would be remiss if I did not mention that Cantwell's take on longtime personal favorite Titanium Man did not ring true to me at all. I just don't see Titanium Man, one of, if not the most hardline communist in the Marvel Universe, being motivated by money. That said, he is visualized wonderfully by Angel Unzueta, and I like him being shown as a threat to Shellhead and War Machine. The new writer, Jerry Duggan, has picked up from where Cantwell left off, using the status quo of Tony having spent most of his fortune to spin off in a new direction. The new story mixes Tony in with elements from the X-Men, which, given Duggan's work on that franchise, is understandable. Overall, Cantwell's turn on Iron Man was a moderate success for me as a fan. I enjoyed Slott's run better with its pie-in-the-sky crazy high technology, but Cantwell's more serious take still had more hits than misses from beginning to end. It's mostly self-contained and well-paced, and gets my recommendation for both Shellhead fans as well as casual readers. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about Iron Man, Luke. Oh, thank you, Luke, for sharing your fandom and your expertise with us here, as I am talking about the book while it's still fresh to me. I think some of your comments fall into the broad category of sometimes it helps to not have history with a title or a character. Because for me, the Wasp relationship was nothing. I didn't know about it. I learned about it in the breakup scene. So that wasn't a change and therefore didn't bother me. I do think, as you said, that Patsy ended up as a good sidekick, a good woman to fill the role that Cantwell wanted for this particular story from the love interest. And overall, I think you and I broadly agree on your last point, and that is that I'd recommend this run as well. Again, thank you, Luke. This is something that he and I do on each other's shows on occasion, which is the concept of pre-feedback. Well, back to the comics. Next up, from the DC app, wrapping up a series I was working my way through a few years back, from the Bendis run, Legion of Superheroes 11 and 12. It ended up being an interesting take on the Great Darkness, a classic bit of Legion lore. And as good as Bendis can be at writing dialogue, a lot of his dialogue sounds the same no matter who says it. That's one of the criticisms with him in general. And one problem with a cast as big as the Legion, it means you have literally dozens of characters who all kind of sound the same. Also, from the app, sort of a joke on it being Adventure Comics Month, I read a few issues of the actual titular comic for the month, Adventure Comics, 381 through 383, all starring the Maid of Might, Sir Dr. Ange's all-time favorite character of Supergirl. And Dr. Ange, we are with you. The cover of 382 was great. Supergirl interrupting her own funeral. That story was okay, but it did not live up to the promise of that cover. But we can say that about a lot of DC books from this era. Of these three, I probably preferred 381 the most, in which Supergirl ends up leading a gang? An all-girl gang of hoodlums? Oh my. And from the Free Table at Capital City Comics, a book from Free Comic Book Day 2021, 10-ton press preview. This issue had four preview stories in it, and two in particular stood out. Red Dawn is not about the movie, although the movie is given a shout-out. Dawn is, in fact, a U.S. government-sponsored superhero, and this laid out an interesting premise for her. And then there was a six-page biography of rocker Rob Halford, which reminded me of the recent episode I recorded of Back to the Bins, where Chris Tyler brought an issue of Rock and Roll Comics. And one that I got from a Kickstarter that involved our good friend Sir Manuel Carmona, which I got signed by Manuel and all his co-creators, not to brag, The Evandris Theory Number 1, described on the inside front cover as a multiversal anthology of the ongoing battle between our young hero, Nico Evandris, and the evil tyrant Emperor Mada. In this one, you have three separate stories, which are connected by the characters, and they're literally connected by dimensional portals. Each section has its own very distinct art style, and I have to say, I really dug Manuel's art, which is in the first story, which he gave the look of the 1970s to 1970s comics, the way the art and the colors are just laid out and set on the page. It really had that newsprint look, even though the paper itself was much better quality than old newsprint. I checked with Manuel, and he did confirm that that was the vibe he was going for, so I get credit for noticing that. This is a very well done independent book, a very independent book, which I'm pretty sure is still for sale. Check out The Evandris Theory on Etsy, available there through the Truthful Comic Store. And if I remember, fingers crossed, please, Professor, remember, I will put a link to buy the comic in the show notes, in the blog post for this episode. Good work, Sir Manuel and team. I mentioned last time that there's a character that I will be reading a bunch of over the next few months, because I will be presenting at the Spider-Man conference at Bowling Green in September. So I plan to flip through a ton of Spidey comics and even read a handful of them as well, such as from the Black and White Essentials number 11, Amazing Spider-Man 231 through 239, and Annuals 16 and 17 from the Roger Stern run. This started off with an actually sort of intricate business-related storyline involving the Brand Corporation, the Tarantula, and Will of the Wisp. That's right, I said it, Will of the Wisp. And the Bugle was, of course, involved in trying to break the story, so those characters are the primary supporting cast for those issues. After that, we get the first appearance of Hobgoblin, and then Annual 16 introduces Monica Rambeau as that Captain Marvel. Both Peter and Spidey have a lot on their plates in these issues, which are very solid 1980s Marvel work. And also another standalone non-continuity miniseries, Spider-Man Life Story 1 through 6 by Chip Zdarsky and Mark Bagley. The premise of this is that it takes place in real time, one issue per decade, covering the 1960s to the 2010s. And it manages to tell a Spidey story that diverges from the traditional canon in interesting ways, while also weaving in important elements from Spidey history as well as broader Marvel history. So, of course, there are clones. I mean, a lot of clones. Superior Doc Ock, Secret Wars, Morlun and the Inheritors. Bits like that are hit directly on. Both Gwen and MJ play important roles, as do most of the expected Spider cast. But what's really different about this is everyone ages, which in mainstream ongoing comics, pretty much never happens. I'm not saying it's a great series, but for me, it really worked as an interesting, fascinating change of pace for a superhero story. And then some kid books that I read. Not a big selection here. There are some more coming after the break. Most of these came from Pulp Reality, and a pair came from Crazy Comics. Betty and Veronica 8, Archie Digest 250, Woody Woodpecker 165, and Archie at Riverdale High 13 and 48. I do want to give a shout out to Woody Woodpecker, because this issue was clearly influenced by Uncle Scrooge and Duck Stories, as Woody and the kids go on an international adventure involving buried treasure and criminals. It really had an Uncle Scrooge vibe to it. And I appreciated them shaking up their formula a bit, trying to turn the character and the title in that more adventurous direction. The Betty and Veronica issue had one of my favorite Christmas stories in it. I know, the timing didn't work out, but you never know what you're going to find inside an Archie issue. You can't always tell by the cover. The story is that the elves find a letter that had been lost in the mail from Betty when she was like 8 years old. Now, since what she was mostly doing was asking for presents for her friends, Santa and the team were so moved by her selflessness that they answered her letter and delivered those presents nearly a decade too late with humorous and touching effects. Riverdale High 48 had a nice story where Chuck Clayton got upset with how his dad, Coach Clayton, was too hard on him as a coach. And so he moved in with another family member over in the Southside High area. But he only lasted there for one baseball game, as his loyalty to Riverdale and his friends came through. The Archie Digest had a nice one-page gag. Archie's hanging up a sign at the school, you know, a big banner, and he pours paint on the bee, knocks one teacher with his ladder, and then drops a hammer on another before unfurling the banner. Observe Accident Prevention Week. Which means it's time to take a break here. And when we come back, we will talk about all the seasonal reading that I did during June.
Once upon a time, five friends who met on the Bot Talk Transformers forum set out to develop a podcast dedicated to their various interests. Transformers, science fiction, fantasy, and comic books. Part fanboys and part assholes, they came to be known as the Fanholes. Their unbridled enthusiasm for podcasting did not end there, and soon enough, their proper podcast spun off into the Fanholes network of podcasts. Besides our podcast proper, the Fanholes soon had a continuum of genre-specific, focused shows such as Mobile Suit Mondays, Transformers Tuesdays, Toku Thursdays, and Sentai Saturdays. New weekly content can be found on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and fanholespodcast.blogspot.com. Fanholes Podcast, the pop culture podcast, made for the fans, by the fans.
And we're back to talk about seasonal reading, which for June means hashtag Adventure Comics Month. There is, of course, a lot of overlap between adventure comics and a lot of other genres. So in this genre, you might find caveman stories, pirate and medieval stories, tales of spies, detectives, samurais, bounty hunters, and, well, adventurers of all sorts. So let's get to it, and these were sent in from a variety of sources, and I'll do my best to identify those as we go. And in approximate alphabetical order, we do have some from Archie. thanks to the good people at Hoopla. First up was a modern take on an Archie story from the classic days, The Man from Riverdale, R-I-V-E-R-D-A-L-E, like The Man from Uncle. This was an Archie 610 through 613 from about a decade ago. In this new version, Archie's mysterious cousin Andy, it turns out, works as a secret agent, bent on taking down the evil organization Crush, for whom the Archie gang's old antagonist, Mad Dr. Doom, is working. Now, just to clarify, this is not our actual historical Dr. Doom, of course. We're talking about the fictional version, one who appeared in Archie comics over the years. And since this is a teen story, the bad guys also have a gorgeous redhead on their side, Sherry the Spy Girl. So in addition to the spy drama elements, we also have our good old-fashioned relationship drama, too. In terms of the plot, it's simple. Archie, believe it or not, gets in over his head by butting in where he doesn't belong. So, yes, it does seem like Mr. Lodge was right about Archie and his penchant for causing trouble. And you know, the older I get, the more I think Mr. Lodge was right about a lot of things, truth be told. This was good spy action, very over the top, but that's what we like about Bond-style spy tales. So enjoyed these ones, which, by the way, were all written by the legendary Tom DeFalco. And Archie's version of the caveman concept, from Pep Digital 52, Archie 1, The Dawn of Time. Now, Archie 1 is not my favorite of the alternate Archie scenarios, but I have to say that the jokes and story scenarios here were often pretty good. Maybe these stories are better in long chunks where you could adjust the expectations as opposed to finding one of these stories in the middle of a normal Archie book where I tend to appreciate them less. So better than I expected, decent comic book slapstick. And Jughead 202 through 205, which appeared with a few other stories in Pep Digital 51. These are the four stories featuring the tales of Jughead Jones, Semi-Private Eye, in which Jughead, based on his vast knowledge of Private Eye film, sets up shop in the back of Pops to help out the people around Riverdale. So he comes to Moose's aid, helps a friend of Dilton, mostly situations that fall outside the regular activities in Archie comics and with new characters, which help these stories stand out. Nice change of pace. And a brief 1960s series from Archie Publications, an attempt to cash in on the doctor craze in TV shows. Marcus Welby led the way, but was by no means the only example of this. And here, in comic form, we have The Adventures of Young Dr. Masters 1 and 2, telling the stories of a young medical doctor who loves research more than treating patients, and his old-school father thinks he needs to change those priorities because he would love to turn his family medical practice over to his egghead son. But the son is pulled out of the lab regularly whenever a doctor is needed in the field. So in two issues, he ends up saving patients trapped at a construction site and in the aftermath of a plane crash. That one featured bad guys with guns, so they definitely did their best to make young Dr. Masters an action hero. Decent stories, with some romance and family drama. And moving away from Archie, but moving to the most appropriate comic book company for this month, Adventure Comics. Maybe the second most appropriate comic book title, which I admit is why I bought this issue a few months ago in prep for this month. Adventurers, Book 2, Number 1. This is a black and white story in the Dungeons and Dragons mode. The art was very strong, by far the best part of the issue. Very well executed, very professional. The problem is, well, nothing really happens in the issue. It's weird because they don't really introduce the characters, because the theories, you've probably read the first volume of stories, which I haven't. But in terms of this story arc, they do treat it like a first issue, with world building and info dumps. It's a strange mix that, for me, a fan of fantasy epics, just didn't work for me as a standalone issue. In a trade featuring the most appropriate comic book character for this month, Adventure Man, 1-4 from Image, from 2020, this was an intriguing one, taking place in the modern world, but bringing in Adventure Man, who had been a fictional pulp character in the history of this world, as images and elements of Adventure Man's past pop up in the modern world. Hip modern girl Claire finds herself becoming the inheritor of this heroic legacy. It's a fun story, but it doesn't wrap anything up by the end of these issues. There is another volume, so I may find out at a later date how the story itself actually wraps up. The Dodsons do the art in these issues, which were all written by Matt Fraction, so rest assured that you have top-level talent on the Adventure Man book. Over to DC, stories of The Son of Thunder, Arrak 27, 36, and 44, sent in by Sir Manuel Carmona. All of these are written by Roy and Dan Thomas, with art in two issues by Ron Randall, and it's Tony DiZuniga in the other. I looked to the DC app for issues to fill in some of the holes between these disparate issues, but I didn't find any Arrak on the app, at least in the basic version of the app. But even with that, I was able to enjoy these issues. There were enough commonalities. I know it wasn't one single mega story, but the vibe of the issues, the traits of the characters, they were consistent, which is one big advantage of having a single driving creative force as the writers. That certainly helps. Reading these ones, I really like the world, how folks with different backgrounds, different religious faiths, could work together to do some good. And from Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, a pair of books that he received via crowdfunding efforts. Biff Stone, Monster Hunter for Hire, number one, and The Good, the Bad, and the Prehistoric. Biff Stone is from Gallant Comics, and our hero is a 70s-style freelance Monster Hunter, complete with gold medallion and open-necked shirt. Of the two, I think I enjoyed this one a bit more. The lead character was more compelling. Having said that, The Good, the Bad, and the Prehistoric from Cosmic Times was certainly enjoyable. The art and coloring gave it more of a lighter tone with smooth character designs that seem straight out of a classic animated movie. The setting was interesting, sort of a frontier town, albeit with some interesting changes to the history. Both were solid. Thank you, Kirk. And know, O listeners, that many years ago I bought a bunch of issues from the Dark Horse Conan run. And this month I read the last of those that I have, Conan 17 and 18. These are written by Kurt Busiek and drawn by Kerry Nord, so they are very good. This is early in Conan's life where he's a thief. These take place appropriately in the City of Thieves. What works for these is that although there is a serial nature to the stories, they do take place in order. Each issue did tell a full story each, and that works for me. and stories of the same character, although the Marvel version this time, Conan the Barbarian, 233 through 235, which were sent in by Manuel. 233 begins with an origin story, as in Conan as a very tiny baby and surviving a night out in the wilderness as a baby. Considering they were going so far away from the Conan canon, and do you want to know how many times it took me to say that properly? The Conan canon? These are pretty solid. I tend to prefer the earlier ones in this Marvel run, make no mistake, but they certainly got the job done. And really from the same world, again from Marvel Comics, the stories where Red Sonja made her comics debut in the 70s, Marvel Feature 1 through 7. Excellent stories featuring, really, the first lady of Adventure Comics. Roy Thomas and Frank Thorne combined to give us wonderful action-packed stories, really laying the groundwork for the next, coming up on 50 years now, worth of stories featuring the She-Devil with a sword. And certainly, yes, Conan does make an appearance with his pirate lady Belit, no less, which makes for some exquisitely awkward moments. Yes, there's a bit of formula here, especially in these early days with the character, but I found these issues interesting, partially as a historical artifact of a new butt-kicking lady character, but also, as more often than not, pretty good comic books in and of themselves. And from the first wave era at DC 2010, Doc Savage 1 through 5. Pick these up from a number of sources at 50 cents or 3 for a dollar. I am a fan of Doc. I think I've read just one of the novels, but a good chunk of his comics. These ones were written by Paul Malmont for the first four issues, and then B. Clay Moore for the fifth. All of the art in all of these is by Howard Porter and Art Tiber, and it looks really good. The opening four issues tell a complete story of Doc and the team being directly attacked on all fronts, having both their home base and their reputations destroyed. And some of this is their own fault. If you remember the old school original stories, Doc had some, what we would now think of as troubling ways of dealing with criminals. And some of that is what is coming back to haunt him, and I like that. These all take place in an alternate DCU. There are references to Batman and a blimp made by Wayne Airships. Now, issue 5 shows the effects of all of this. It's a one-off story that takes place in Greece, and running through all of these issues is a 5-part backup featuring the Avenger and Justice Incorporated, and that was a very strong story as well. So between that and Doc Savage, I found these very enjoyable action reads. And I read after that a book that came out a little bit earlier, the Batman Doc Savage Special, which I guess kicked off the first wave line. It is an interesting team-up, with Doc as the well-known celebrity and Batman as the new untrusted kid in town. I am a fan of a lot of Brian Azzarello's work and thought he did a good job writing this one. And an issue from Paper Cuts from 2005. One of the great American properties, Hardy Boys, number 1 of 3. The art was a little simplistic for my tastes, although it probably fit just right for the YA audience they were going for. We don't get much action in the first issue, just some intrigue and laying of groundwork. But I really liked the mid-2000s-isms, like the Internet Cafe and the PDA and the American Idol knockoff. You know, it was fine. 50 cents at Pulp Reality may have been a bit much for this first issue, truth be told, but it was fine. In a series sent in partially by Sir Iowa's Joe, then I supplemented with a few issues from Hoopla, Jennifer Blood, Bloodlines, 1 through 5. There's a town where mobsters, who turn state's evidence, end up, and which the U.S. just lets govern itself as long as they keep it all within the borders. As a premise, this is not dissimilar from the scenario in the series Postal, but it does play out quite differently. Where Jennifer Blood comes in is that she has a big grudge against the mob for some really good reasons. And since there are a whole bunch of them together in one town, she makes it her mission to kill each and every one of them. Punisher-style action ensues, and she ends up going mano a mano with a super hot hit lady called in from Europe to protect this town. This was wild, this was extreme, but it actually delivered pretty well. There are more Jennifer Blood miniseries out there, and I may check some of those out down the road. And a fun combination of various Golden Age heroes, Masks, 1 through 8 from Dynamite. This is about a decade or so ago. The key is the cast. If this list of characters intrigues you, excites you, then check the book out. If not, it may not be for you. But a strong-armed political party takes over New York City and then the state with eyes on Washington, D.C. The strong-armed politicians institute martial law, curfews, lockdowns, mandates, speech codes, and a group of vigilantes respond. Green Hornet and Kato, The Shadow, Miss Fury, Zorro, The Black Bat, The Spider, Green Llama, and more. They each fight on their own, eventually becoming aware of each other, and then, wait for it. That's right. They team up. And more spoilers, I guess, they succeed. Fun, good old-timey adventure story. Alex Ross did all of the art in the first issue, and I am a fan. That really helped set the template for the series for me. And speaking of, we have a modern take on one of those classic pulp heroes, The Shadow, 2 through 4. This was a Howard Chaykin DC miniseries, 4 issues, from 1986, and I picked these three up from a $3 for $1 box at Carolina Comics and more. If you hear Chaykin's name and assume that this is just going to be another comic full of gangsters and sex workers and violence and corrupt politicians, shame on you. Well, actually, pretty much have this series figured out to a T. When you think about it, The Shadow is one of those characters who becomes less and less appropriate as time goes by. So setting him in a more modern era, more modern story, is an interesting take. The ability to cloud people's minds, aka overriding people's agency, and, of course, the pair of super guns he always fires. And that is a bit of what Chaykin is getting at here, pointing out that the character is a bit troubling, while giving us his usual gritty, harsh take. And a title from the public domain, a move that I know Sir Luke Giaconetti approves of, from Fiction House Publishers from the early 1950s, Sheena, Queen of the Jungle 17 and 18. Standard white savior tropey stories, but with one distinctive feature, and that is Sheena herself. Her love interest, Bob, is routinely kidnapped and is truly not suited for jungle life, and she always has to rescue him while also fighting big cats and elephants and ivory poachers and also forging peace between various warring tribes. It is a heck of a busy life for Sheena, but she is more than capable of doing this and more. There is never a hint of her being too weak, too, quote-unquote, feminine, to handle her wide variety of duties. Look, ruling a huge jungle, it is not a job for the faint of heart. And from one of the original characters in the adventure genre, just when it was becoming a genre 100 plus years ago. Tarzan 132 and 137, these ones are from Gold Key. I've read a decent amount of Tarzan comics over the years, and a decent amount of Gold Key comics over the years, but I don't think I'd ever read many, or even any, Gold Key Tarzan books. So I wasn't sure what to expect of these, but they weren't bad, and they had enough references to the Burroughs' work that I could see these taking place more or less, sort of, in that original world. There were oversized animals, eagles in this case, that Tarzan could ride, and hidden civilizations, in one case, an Egyptian-style land. I can be a little snobby about the takes on Tarzan that I like. Basically, the closer to ERB, the better. That's my general take. And by that measure, these weren't bad. I might even say, surprisingly, solid. And another Gold Key classic character, from before he was branded as a dinosaur hunter. Because back then, he was Turok, Son of Stone. 9 issues, 58, 87, 91, 93, 101, 103, 118, 124, and 125. A good number of these came from Sir Rob Lance, at least one from Tom Panarese, and then a few more were purchased at great prices. Many of these are of shaky condition, but the stories are consistently pretty good. You have Turok and young Andar with the same overarching problem in each issue. I mean, this was the premise of the series. They have to find a way out of the Great Valley so they can rejoin their tribe and their families. Unfortunately for them, but fortunately for us as readers, the valley is just brimming with dangers and obstacles. Dinosaurs of all kind, or honkers, as they call them. Cavemen, warring tribes, poison arrows, the occasional damsel who needs a rescue, and very harsh terrain. Not that every story is wholly original or stands out, but overall, what surprised me here was how much variety there was in these stories, how much quality there was in the adventures, and how little, like I said, how little straight repetition there was, considering there is just one story. They have to get out of the Great Valley. Now, of course, I have to say, Turok in particular, maybe Gold Key in general, this is one case where coverless comics really are a drawback. Because on those Gold Key comics, you know this, those painted style covers, those are pretty much always the best bits of art in the series. So when I have a coverless issue of Turok, I really do feel like I'm missing an important element of the comic. Andar and Turok are native peoples and are referred to using the I word regularly, the common terminology of the time, despite being, I mean, not just offensive, but geographically wholly inaccurate. But consider that a content warning, just so you know. And 2 issues featuring one of the great adventure characters of all time, Uncle Scrooge Adventures, 1 and 29 from the late 1980s. Issue 1, sent to me by Ron Sadowski, is, I'm not going to lie, a terrific issue, with a classic reprint of McDuck of Arabia, a globetrotting Karl Barks epic. I recently saw a video of Chuck Dixon talking glowingly about Karl Barks, how he combined action and humor in a way that just about no other writer can. I mentioned earlier in the episode how much I appreciated Woody Woodpecker trying to turn that title a little bit in the Scrooge direction, but there's nothing like the original. These are excellent, fun, wonderful stories. Now, sometimes looking for comics for these themed months is a judge a book by the cover situation. So while I was flipping through the 50-cent boxes at Pulp Reality earlier in the year, I saw a cover with a man and a woman back-to-back wearing sort of safari-style vests. He has a hat. They both have guns. There's a pyramid in the background. All of that communicated adventure comic. But when I got to about page 5 of 48, which was nice, of Innovation Comics' Vigil, Kukulkan, I flipped back to that cover and noticed a few things. One, the lady on the cover was a bit pale, a bit light blue almost in skin tone. And if you look really close at her mouth, you do see the fangs. Because yes, she's a vampire. But while this book does touch on the horror genre, obviously, I still think it works as an adventure comic, more or less. She and the fella are together. They're a couple. She's a vampire and he's not. And the story does address the problems that that can cause in a relationship. The specific story is about them seeking a cure for her vampirism, which takes them to a Central American cult. And that is where the adventure comics genre elements really take over from the horror bits. Solid 1990s black and white comic. And that was a solid collection of adventure comics. Next month is another fun genre. As for July, the month that contains the National Day of the Cowboy, we will do some hashtag Western Comics Month reading. However, before we wrap, we need to point out that June is not just for adventure. It is also the start of summer and the start of summer vacations. And I read a few comics related to that theme as well. DC Superhero Girls, Summer Olympus graphic novel. It's been a few years since I've read anything in the DC superhero world, but I still found this thoroughly enjoyable. There are high school versions of almost every female hero and villain in the DC universe in here somewhere. From Wonder Woman, Supergirl, to Harley, to Bumblebee, Batgirl, Barda, even Thunder and Lightning. In this one, it's summer, and Diana is summoned by Zeus to spend her break with him at Olympus. Eventually, Ares and Strife get involved, and they end up in our cities causing, that's right, war and strife. And they are defeated by, spoilers, cover your ears, the power of friendship. And an Archie collection, Pep Digital 155, Betty and Veronica, Lifeguard on Duty. Yes, I knew that the Riverdale crew spent a lot of time in the summer at the beach, but I never really thought about how many of those beach stories involve either someone in the gang being a lifeguard, usually Archie or Betty, or someone in the gang interacting with a lifeguard, often in a flirtatious manner. But as I've said before, over the course of 75 plus years, any premise you can think of, no matter how niche, like lifeguards, you can find 80 to 135 pages of Archie content on that premise. Two stories in particular stand out in this volume, one from all the way back in 1945, which was an interesting time capsule and an interesting look at what the exciting swimwear was of that era. The other was a PSA-type story where Betty teaches the whole gang and us readers how to perform CPR. Good on you, Betty. And I think that's everything. In terms of what I really enjoyed this month, of course, Manuel's Evandris Theory issue is very impressive. That reprint story in Uncle Scrooge 1 is terrific. The Red Sonja stories in Marvel Feature were fun reads. Adventure Comics 31 with Supergirl was fun. Masks was really good. But in terms of my absolute favorite, and this was definitely a surprise to me, but an unexpected favorite. But I really enjoyed the intro of Monica Rambeau making Amazing Spider-Man Annual 16 my surprising favorite read of the month. Next month, I'm not really sure what I'm going to be reading other than some books full of horses and frontiers and gunfights for July. But other than that, who knows? But whatever I do end up reading, I will be here to talk about the books I read in July in an episode that ought to be out in early August. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the books that I've mentioned. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for the episode that blog is at, relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek, and of course the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.